Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start as we always do with the region's news. In Beijing, the Chinese government announced attendees for its World War II anniversary parade. Vladimir Putin and Park Geun-hye headlined the eclectic list of 30 world leaders. However, Shinzo Abe's office announced he will not visit China the week of September 3rd. US Ambassador Max Baucus will represent the United States. China's stock market slide continued this week, with global markets also seesawing, including the Dow Jones and Nasdaq. The People's Bank of China cut interest rates and the reserve requirement ratio on Tuesday in another effort to break out of declining growth and market turmoil. In Kuala Lumpur, thousands of Malaysian protesters plan to demand Prime Minister Najib Razak's ousting this weekend following revelations that someone transferred nearly $700 million into his personal accounts. The continuing scandal has rocked the country's political establishment and compelled foreign investors to withdraw holdings in Malaysian assets. The rally, titled Bersih 4, has begun to meet resistance from Malaysian authorities through online censorship. In India, violent clashes over a caste-based affirmative action program in the western state of Gujarat left 9 people dead and scores injured by Wednesday night. The Indian Army was deployed after martial law was imposed in the Gujarati capital of Ahmedabad. Prime Minister Narendra Modi appealed for calm after a protest by a group traditionally disadvantaged through the caste system, yet now wealthy through the local diamond trade, spun out of control. In Tokyo, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe asked US President Barack Obama on Wednesday to investigate alleged spying on senior Japanese government and corporate officials. The request follows a WikiLeaks release in July of a list of alleged Japanese targets of the National Security Agency. During an extended phone conversation, President Obama apologized to Abe and the Japanese government over the suspected eavesdropping. On the Korean Peninsula, representatives from North and South Korea reached an agreement to stand down Tuesday morning following 43 hours of marathon diplomatic negotiations. The agreement aims to lower the temperature following steady military escalation since early August. And that's the news. As I mentioned, on the Korean Peninsula this week, South Korea and North Korea reached an agreement averting the possibility of a full-blown crisis for now. The four basic provisions of the agreement include South Korea promising to stop loudspeaker broadcasts along the demilitarized zone, North Korea expressing regret over an August 4th mine attack and agreeing to lift its semi-war state, a Red Cross working level meeting scheduled for early September with the aim of holding family reunions during this year's Chuseok, or Korean Thanksgiving, and further regular talks to improve inter-Korea relations. My colleague and editor of the CSIS Asia Policy blog, Jeff Bean, sat down with CSIS Korea Chair Victor Cha to discuss how the two Koreas got to a point of crisis, the key takeaways from the agreement, and why both governments were willing to stand down.
Hi, I'm Jeff Bean, editor of the CSIS Asia Policy podcast, Kajit Asia. I'm joined today by Dr. Victor Cha, our Korea Chair and Senior Advisor here at CSIS, to discuss the recent tensions on the Korean Peninsula and the agreement, which appears to have diffused the mini crisis that was brewing. Victor, I want to ask you, how did this crisis develop?
Well, the relationship, people have to remember, was not good prior to this crisis. There was really not a lot of dialogue between the two Koreas. Every initiative the South Koreans made for family reunifications or other sorts of confidence-building measures were all spurned by the North Koreans. But this particular crisis really started with something that happened in the beginning of August, August 4th, two South Korean soldiers were patrolling areas along the DMZ as they normally do and stepped on a landmine that we understand should not have been there, that had clearly been planted there. And the landmine blew off the legs and the feet of the two patrolling soldiers. This was considered to be a provocation by the North. The North has had a history of digging subterraneanly underneath tunnels, large network of tunnels that were found in the 1970s, and this looked like another much smaller scale but still quite aggressive move by the North. And the South responded by not retaliating kinetically, but by removing the 11-year hiatus on the broadcast of messages from loudspeakers along the DMZ into North Korea. And so the South started those broadcasts again, and that's what then created the North Korean reaction, the threat to attack those speakers, and then actually carrying through on those and firing on those speakers, to which the South Koreans responded with 155 millimeter shells. And that's how we got into the crisis that we saw last week.
So in your view, we get to the point of crisis. We reach an agreement after hours and hours of negotiations between the government. What are the key takeaways for you from this agreement?
Well, there are a few. I think the first is that this crisis really diffused much faster than most people expected. I thought that this would go on for some time. The North Koreans posed an ultimatum directly to the South Korean National Security Advisor, saying if they didn't stop the broadcasting by a certain hour, that the North would essentially attack all of the 11 speaker sites along the DMZ. And they were clearly mobilizing to do something as they made the threat. So this looked like it might go on for some time, and it diffused fairly quickly. So that, I think that was one positive takeaway. I think the other was that it clearly showed, and consistent with research we've done here at CSIS, that the proximate cause for North Korean provocations during a period of U.S. ROK military exercising, which is what we were in August, annual exercises, that the proximate cause for North Korean belligerence is not the exercises themselves. There's a popular view out there. It's in part supported or encouraged by North Korean rhetoric that the annual U.S. ROK exercises, which take place twice a year, once in the spring and once in late summer, when these exercises take place, they are what cause provoke the North Koreans into undertaking the sort of actions that they do. And this is a narrative the North likes to put out there. CSIS did a study looking back over 10 years and found that there is not really this sort of provocative effect that the U.S. ROK defensive military exercises have on North Korean behavior. And North Korean behavior is much more a function of the pre-existing relationship prior to the start of those exercises. So the second takeaway for me is that, consistent with our findings in this study, the North Korean actions were not a response to the military provocations, but were a response to what happened prior to the military exercises, which is this August 4th landmine blast. So it was consistent with our study. And in fact, the North Koreans in their negotiations were not demanding an end to the U.S. military exercises to defuse the crisis. They were focused on the loudspeaker broadcasts. So that was the second. And then the third, and we can certainly talk about this some more, is that the degree to which they were really fixated on the loudspeaker broadcast, the degree to which it clearly bothered them, and that was their primary objective in the negotiations, not to stop the military exercises, not to get money, not to get food, not to get any of those things, but just to stop the loudspeaker broadcast, which to me was quite unusual.
What do you think it tells us about both governments that they were willing to de-escalate in this way, either because of concerns about security, very real, or concerns about loudspeaker broadcasts as a point of negotiation? Do you think that this indicates a hint of rationality and realism sort of entering into the typical DPRK cycle of brinksmanship we've seen over the last couple of years? And what does it tell us about Madam Park's government?
Well, with regard to Madam Park, I think it does show that she is really not willing to accept North Korean brinksmanship. And she's had a fairly strong backbone throughout her presidency when it came to issues on North Korea. And, this was really the first crisis we've had in 5 years. The last one was the Chunan sinking and the shelling of the islands in 2010. And so this was the first really under her presidency. And, she did not budge an inch. And so in that sense, I think the South Korean public was very supportive of her because she was not wishy-washy when it came to this. On the other hand, though, you don't want that to lead to some sort of overconfidence, a feeling that, we can stand tough with the North and they'll back down every time. On the North Korean side, it's always refreshing to be able to say it looked like there was some rationality there and that they wanted to defuse a crisis. But at the same time, we should not have too much confidence in that. Just based on this, you know, basically 72-hour or so crisis, that we can now extrapolate from that the young North Korean leader is fully and capably rational. I still think we don't know the answer to that. Like I said, it looked very rational from the North Koreans' perspective because they had one very narrow but what appeared to be very important objective, and that was to stop the speaker broadcast going into the North.
And where do you think we should focus our attention going forward? Is it the implementation of the agreement, looking at bilateral relations, how this will affect broader Northeast Asian politics? What do you think?
So I think there are three things. The first is obviously implementation of the agreement. The primary tangible, aside from diffusing the tension, is another set of family reunions around Chuseok, which is the Korean version of Thanksgiving, in late September. And so they have meetings, working-level meetings, set for next week to try to set that up. So we'll have to see how those go. So implementation is one. The other is to look at this in the context of the three-way relationship between the United States, North Korea, and South Korea, and the extent to which the North Koreans are going to then use this agreement to pivot to a strategy that aims to split the United States and South Korea. This has long been a tried practice by the North Koreans. They've alternated over the years, engaging South Korea while they hold the United States away, engaging the United States while they hold South Korea away, in the hopes of trying to split the alliance or try to cause some friction there. And so with family reunions in September and perhaps more family reunions in the fall, they might be trying to engage North Korea, trying to get some food aid, some flood relief funds from the South, at the same time that they may be holding the United States away with possibly nuclear tests or missile tests later this fall. And then the third thing, I think, from the U.S. and South Korean perspective and others is, again, to really take a careful look at how these speaker broadcasts really seem to impact North Korea. Loudspeaker broadcasts, propaganda broadcasts across the DMZ went on all the time during the Cold War. As we said earlier, they had not happened for 11 years until this week. But clearly the content of the broadcasts were bothering the North Koreans. It wasn't just Korean pop music or the latest world news, but the difference, I think, in the content this time was that they had recent defectors, basically giving testimony over the loudspeakers about how they had decided to leave, how life was better in the South, how the North Korean leader was a fraud. And so it really seemed to bother the North Koreans that there were these attacks on the legitimacy of the leadership. And we've seen this before, the way the North Koreans, particularly under Kim Jong-un, the way the North Koreans reacted to the screening of the movie The Interview, which ridiculed the North Korean leader. Anytime there's been something that personally attacks the legitimacy of the North Korean leader, the regime seems to be hypersensitive to that under Kim Jong-un, under this leadership that's now still only 4 years old. So I think that's the third thing to be watching, is the extent to which this crisis actually showed us that there is a new leverage point on North Korea, which is this use of information. In many ways, it wasn't the 155 rounds that the South Koreans fired back on the North in the altercation. It was the words that they were sending across, 12 to 15 miles into North Korea, to young, probably undernourished and overworked North Korean recruits who are sitting there wondering, what the heck they're doing with their life, standing in the middle of a forest, trying to defend a small patch of earth when they're hearing these broadcasts that say life is so much better on the other side. I think this is something that's going to be very interesting to watch. And it also, I think, reflects the degree of insecurity the regime has about its legitimacy because of the fact that it is so sensitive, hypersensitive, to this sort of criticism from the outside.
Victor, we'll have to watch it really closely. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Victor Cha. Now on to our one to watch. In the ongoing struggle for clean energy, India has made a unique breakthrough. An airport in the southwestern Indian city of Kochi is now the world's first fully solar-powered airport. Cochin International Airport boasts 46,150 solar panels laid across 45 acres, which can generate 12 megawatts at peak conditions, making the airport's electricity consumption completely carbon neutral. According to a press release from the Airport Ownership Group, over the next 25 years, the project will save substantial carbon dioxide emissions from coal-fired power plants, providing Indian residents the benefits equivalent to planting 3 million trees or not driving 750 million miles. Extra megawatts generated from the grid are already being sold to local housing developments in Kerala State. The airport plans to open a new international terminal in May 2016. That's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and also check out our island tracker and maritime specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.